Ross Baker, Professor Baker, let me ask you this. I think it's fair to say that I lean sort of moderately liberal in terms of my opinions. And yet, I would consider voting for Chris Christie for just about anything these days after he put his arm around Obama and maybe won the election for the president. Well, what do you think?
Well, there's no question about it, but that, I have this theory that having not made the ticket and being edged out by Paul Ryan, that he went off to sulk in his tent and I think decided he was going to do as little as possible to help Mitt Romney accept the absolute minimum in terms of being a surrogate. In fact, he spent most of his time as a surrogate supporting Republican members of Congress rather than basically hitting the circuit for Romney. But there's no question but that he did help the president. I don't know whether there were many people who at that stage in the campaign were swung over from being Romney voters to being Obama voters based on that pageant on the beach. But it certainly did help, and it certainly aided his standing in the state. I mean, his poll numbers are out of sight in New Jersey right now. There was just a poll taken by the Eagleton Institute, a place you know quite well, indicating that he's got an approval rating coming up on 70%, which is astonishing. It's hard to think of a public figure in America who's got numbers like that.
Yes, and the amazing thing were the number of Democrats who went from 23% all the way up to the top in support of him.
Yeah, and I think that it was his astuteness in understanding that the magnitude of the tragedy that occurred on the Jersey Shore was something that it was essential to transcend partisan differences. You know, from a very practical point of view, he knew he would need federal money, and it made little sense to, I think, any politician with the gifts that he had to snub or high hat the president. And in fact, by putting his arm around Christie, I think the president, in a sense, kind of derived some of the popularity that Christie enjoys. So it works both ways. He helped Christie and Christie helped him.
Now, but when you run for president, which he may want to do at some point in the future, you have to convince the Republican primary voters, who are often the angriest and the meanest, that you're a good guy. Will they forget this?
Right. Angry, mean, and the most likely to turn out in primary elections.
Right.
Right. And I think that he hopes that the kind of grassroots Republican support that he enjoys would neutralize those, I think, relatively few people in the Republican primary who look upon him as an apostate or as, someone who is trafficking with the enemy. And I think he feels he can overcome that. But even before the vignette on the beach, he would have had trouble with that constituency. Although he is nominally pro-life, he has never, at least in my memory, ever made abortion an issue in his campaign. His bipartisanship is genuine. I mean, he understood that he could not govern New Jersey effectively with hostility towards a Democratic Assembly and Senate. So, he made his peace with them. Likewise, I think he can make his peace with the Republican right wing.
And yet he has some fiscal discipline that is not always characteristic of Democrats. Isn't that true?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think, the state has considerable amount of indebtedness. And repairing the damage of the storm is going to be colossally expensive, and not all of it's going to be paid for by the federal government. He said that he's already announced he's going to run again in 2013, which is, after all, only a year from now. And the process of rebuilding New Jersey, the eastern part of New Jersey, is very complicated and involves a lot of potential political controversies, including to the extent to which you want to allow people whose homes were destroyed along the ocean to rebuild along the ocean. And there's a feeling that's likely to develop as the cost of this begins to sink in, that perhaps, you know, many of these beachfront properties ought not to be rebuilt, and that there ought to be a somewhat more conservative planning policy in terms of where these, you know, where these properties go.
We're coming very close to the side of the fiscal cliff. You've worked for a lot of United States senators. So what are they talking about now? If we were in their inner offices right now and they were sitting around with a bunch of contributors or staff, what would they be saying?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of information out there. And the positions, I think, are pretty well known. And I think it's just a question of getting there. I mean, there are all kinds of various plans that were floated over the course of the last year since the crisis in August over the debt limit extension. So there's the Simpson-Bowles plan. There's the plan from the Senate Gang of Six. And most of these are bipartisan plans. There's the Alice Rivlin-Pete Domenici plan. So, you know, there's a lot of grist for that mill. There are lots of ways to get to a proper solution. I think everybody knows what they are, and the question is, how do you fashion the mechanism for doing it? And that very often is the problem. You know, how do you overcome the problem of filibusters in the Senate? How do you overcome the problem of a very, very strongly intransigent Republican caucus that really opposes anything that really even has the faintest scent of tax increases? And I think these are the kinds of things that they're mulling over right now.
Talk to me about the filibuster, which you just mentioned. So it takes 60 votes to overcome somebody who starts to read the telephone book or threatens to read the telephone book more recently. Now, there is a plan out there to do away with the filibuster as we know it. What is that?
Well, there's several. There is, first of all, almost no one I know in the Senate favors abandoning the filibuster completely. Because, you know, it's one of these situations, Alan, in which, you know, if you really want a good example of the aphorism, where you stand depends on where you sit, this would be it. That when you're in the majority, you hate the filibuster. It's obstructionist, it's dilatory, it wastes time, it blocks legislation. If you're in the minority, however, you see it as the sturdy protection of the rights of the minority. So certainly Senator Reid, the Democratic leader, certainly wants to change the filibuster, and there are a couple of possibilities. First of all, it's interesting to note that you can filibuster at any one of six points in a legislative process. To my mind, the mind of many people who are familiar with the filibuster, the least defensible portion of the filibuster, the least defensible occasion on which the filibuster can be used, is what's called the motion to proceed. And I don't want to get into, you know, the weeds of the legislative process, but filibustering the motion to proceed means literally that you cannot debate the bill. That it's blocked at the earliest outset. There's no debate at all, and therefore, you know, if 60 votes aren't achieved, the bill doesn't get debated. That seems to be the least defensible element of the filibuster. If that could be eliminated, the opposition, the minority, still has five other chances to filibuster, all the way to the point of sending setting up a conference committee for meeting with the House.
Now, Ross Baker, we're going to have to stop there now. But when we come back the next time, we'll pick it up on the filibuster. It's a fascinating area.
Yeah.
And thank you so much. Ross Baker, of course, is at Rutgers University, is a professor, PhD from the University of Pennsylvania. He's worked on the staffs of five U.S. senators and a member of the House. And, of course, he has served as scholar in residence in the office of Majority Leader Harry Reid. He's also considered by me and many other people as the top person in legislative politics in America. Ross, thanks for being with us.
Sure thing, Alan.